This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shmita Basu. Today, what a Harris or a Trump win would mean for America. We are days away from Election Day, and the two competing visions for the country from the presidential candidates couldn't be more different.
We're running against something far bigger than Joe or Kamala, and far more powerful than them, which is a massive, vicious, crooked, radical left machine that runs today's Democrat Party.
That's former President Donald Trump at his rally at Madison Square Garden last weekend.
They are indeed the enemy from within, but this is who we're fighting.
Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris delivered her closing argument to voters this week at the Ellipse in Washington, D.C.
And this election is more than just a choice between two parties and two different candidates. It is a choice about whether we have a country rooted in freedom for every American or ruled by chaos and division.
She spoke from the same place where Trump held his rally on January 6th, before a violent mob of his supporters stormed the Capitol building.
America, this is not a candidate for president who is thinking about how to make your life better. This is someone who is unstable, obsessed with revenge, consumed with grievance, and out for unchecked power.
With just days to go, I wanted to sit down with politics reporters Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. They're sometimes collaborators and always married. Peter is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, and Susan is a staff writer at the New Yorker. The last time I spoke with them was almost exactly 2 years ago about their book, The Divider, an extensive history of the Trump presidency that relied on lots of sources inside and close to the Trump White House. I asked them to come back on now to take stock of the moment we're in, with two very unique and historic campaigns, though for different reasons, two contrasting visions for America being pitched to voters, and to talk to them about what a victory for either candidate would mean for our country.
We're in a more polarized time than we have been probably in our lifetime, right? And not to say that there aren't other times in American history we've been particularly divided, but this one is as pronounced as ever. And the polls show we don't even want to talk to people who are on the other side. You know, they used to do polls back in the early 60s. They asked, would it bother you if your son or daughter married somebody from the other party? And about 4 or 5% at the time said yes. Today it's closer to 50%, right? I don't want no Republican at my Thanksgiving table. I don't want no Democrat coming for Christmas. We don't want to be communicating with each other, and we're not communicating with each other. And therefore, having this conversation means you're on one side or the other. It's us versus them. And that's something Trump, of course, encourages. Us versus them is the centerpiece, the signature strategy in some ways of his politics. And that's why we called our book The Divider. You know, politics is about dividing. It's about saying who's better. My candidate is better than your candidate. My policy is better than your policy, and here's why. But most presidents at least gave a nod to the idea that they realized their job, their role, was to be, sometimes at least, the unifier of the country, right? They said this. Bill Clinton said he wanted to be the repairer of the breach, and George W. Bush said he wanted to be a uniter, not a divider. And George H.W. Bush talked about, you know, a kinder, gentler nation. And Barack Obama said, we're not a red America and a blue America. We're a United States of America. Well, that's something you've never heard from Donald Trump. That's not his way of approaching things. He's never, in fact, tried to reach out to people who don't agree with him. He has only tried to encourage and galvanize the people who already do. And that's why you see this is as absolutely split down the middle as we could be. We are a 50-50 country or very close to that right now. And that's how he has played politics. He didn't start this. We were already divided before he got there. But he has certainly, I think, taken advantage of it and encouraged it.
Peter, you came out with a piece recently in the Times detailing all of the scandals, all of the accusations of wrongdoing. You wrote, it's kind of hard to lay out a scorecard, but then you sort of did that in a very, very long piece. Can you remind our listeners, to the extent that you can, briefly, a little bit of this history and maybe speak to why you decided to write this piece in this way?
there's a lot in there. And I think it's important to remind people because it is his record, right? I think that he, at his rallies, says that, you know, all the prosecutions against him and the lawsuits against him, it's all just a plot. It's all just a witch hunt by the Democrats out to get him. But if you actually look at his 78 years on this planet, he's been in scandals from the very beginning. This is not new, and it's certainly not always been about Democrats by any stretch or even about politics. But he has, from the time he got into business in the 1970s, been, you know, sued for racial discrimination by the Justice Department. Our colleagues have documented time and time again how he used the tax code to avoid paying taxes. He had 11 out of 18 years that we looked at his tax returns in which he paid $0 in federal income taxes. I don't know about you, but I have not paid $0 in federal income taxes any year in my life. He managed to avoid the draft by getting a tenant of one of his father's apartment buildings, a podiatrist, to write him a bone spur diagnosis. He has had three wives and reportedly at least cheated on all three of them. He's been accused of sexual harassment or worse by a couple dozen women. He's been found liable by one court of sexual abuse of E. Jean Carroll. He's been found liable by another court of massive business fraud. His company was found guilty in a criminal court of tax cheating. This is all aside from the four indictments against him personally that we have talked about in the conviction in the hush money case in New York. He is a remarkable figure in our history in that sense for surviving these kind of scandals. Any other politician I've ever covered, one of these would have been enough to have sidelined their career.
I mean, no kidding. Susan, what do you make of how he has been able to survive politically with all of this baggage?
Yeah, I mean, the lack of accountability obviously is a sort of a through line in Donald Trump's career that predates his political career just since 2015 in the last 8 years. Donald Trump has the possibility of not only becoming president, but doing so in a way that would flaunt or disregard or not have the guardrails in place that might constrain him. And so when you talk about a man who has been able to shatter norms and laws with impunity largely throughout his career, I think that's pretty relevant, especially in light of the Supreme Court decision earlier this year, essentially suggesting that the president has much vaster scope for action than we might have even realized until this court decision, this immunity decision. So I think it's extremely important.
Yeah, I mean, can I just say there have definitely been a few times in this election cycle where I've been reading an article that's comparing Trump versus Harris, I mean, maybe comparing their economic policies, for example. And I just have a moment where I'm like, have we totally lost the thread here? Hold on. What are we talking about? Truly, what are we talking about? For all the reasons you're outlining yourselves just now. I mean, I wish that we were just talking about the policies, right? I think many people do. But this doesn't feel like an election that's about policy comparison at its core. It feels like, in a lot of ways, a referendum on our national identity, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you see this election as a gauge of, a referendum on?
Yeah, I mean, look, policies obviously matter still, and they're important to voters. But, you know, it's not, I think, the sort of the central question that history will look back on. For Vice President Harris, her coalition right now includes everybody from Bernie Sanders to Dick Cheney. That's not a policy coalition. That's a coalition of people who believe that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy because he has indicated that he doesn't believe in elections that he doesn't win. He has said that he would favor termination of the Constitution if it meant getting him back into office. He has talked about taking retribution against his enemies. He has talked about using the military in the streets to go after people who don't agree with him. That's not about policy. It's a lot more about our identity as a country. And Susan and I were both at Madison Square Garden for the Trump rally, 6 hours, I think it was, with all of the pre-speakers. And the thing you walk away from that is how different people in that arena look at the world versus the people who are at a Kamala Harris rally, right? For them, it's about grievance and anger and resentment and the notion that somehow they're both, oddly enough, the silent majority and a persecuted minority all at the same time. And he has tapped into that in a very powerful way. How else to explain that he has nearly half of the voters there? They're not rooting for him necessarily to do all the things he says he's going to do. They may not even know about all the things he says he's going to do, but they sense in him somebody who represents a disruptive force to a system that they believe somehow has left them behind. And he, of course, is taking advantage of this moment for his own personal interests as well. If he doesn't win this election, he knows there's a good chance he may go to jail. And if he wins, he maybe will stay out of it. So that's hard to disassociate from everything that's going on as well. And he is very angry at the people that he believes have come after him, and he wants to use this election for what he calls retribution. That's his word, not mine. Retribution is what he wants this next term to be about.
Well, I think there's also a fundamental dishonesty that Trump has benefited from in this frame of, well, it's really just about policy and let's not make it about personalities. Many of his defenders in the Republican Party, this crucial segment of what you would call sort of the non-MAGA part of the Republican electorate, I think they're the ones who are particularly responsible for this fallacy of the, you know, let's just talk about Donald Trump's policies as if there was sort of this, you know, deeply rational kind of analytical, you know, policy wonk once you strip away all the bombast and the crude racism and misogyny. But of course, that's not true. If you actually look at a lot of what Trump has offered the public in this election cycle as, quote, policy, it boils down to magical thinking. It boils down to almost a dictatorial view of I alone can fix it, which, of course, was his famous quote from the first campaign. But even in this campaign, what his formula for the economy is, I will make it great. His formula for the war in Ukraine is, I will wave my magic wand and it will go away within 24 hours. Spoiler alert, it's not going to go away in 24 hours. Again and again and again, what passes for a sort of policy discourse is really, you know, a form of believe in me and I will take care of everything. And actually, at that Madison Square Garden rally, I found the slogan that they flashed on the screen when Trump finally did come on after 5 hours of warm-up acts, and Trump can fix it.
We'll fix it.
You know, it's about the leader. It's about the leader.
Yeah.
I think people don't understand, actually, that this is literally the first time since the Republican Party was formed in the mid-19th century that they've ever had one person be the party's nominee in three consecutive elections. And it gives you both a sense of how much Trump has transformed the Republican Party into the party of Trump. But also, I think it suggests that its future is very unclear, whether he wins or loses this election, because it has become so dominated by the sort of adulation for a singular leader.
I want to go back for a moment to what you were saying about the guardrails that were in place the first time around. As I mentioned, you know, the last time that we sat down together, we were talking about your book, The Divider, in which you spoke to so many people who were inside the Trump White House and who had really alarming things to say about just how dangerous Trump's presidency was for democracy, for diplomacy, for the world. But they also largely seemed to be saying we were the guardrails, right? We, the public servants, kept things from going off the rails. But as we know, so many ex-Trump White House folks now are coming out. They are not endorsing him. And they're really warning against him, even using words like fascist, that he is a fascist. Have you been in touch with any folks from the ex-Trump White House recently? And what are they saying to you?
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. I mean, think about this. This is the first president we can think of in our lifetime who's not supported for another term by his own vice president.
Sure.
Who's not supported for another term by his own secretary of state, his own secretary of defense, his own chief of staff, his own national security advisor, his own press secretary, and so on and so forth. We could go down the list. And that's really remarkable. We've never seen such a thing. If there had been one person from the Kamala Harris cabinet or the Biden cabinet who said, well, I'm not for Harris this time, people would be, whoa, that's a big deal. We've just come to accept that this is the norm under Trump, in which he hires people, they find him disturbing, troubling, immoral, unconstitutional, threatening, whatever, they quit or he fires them, they speak out, and then people just kind of move on. So John Kelly, the former chief of staff, comes out recently, tells my colleague Michael Schmidt from the New York Times and talks to the Atlantic as well about his worries about fascism, that word you used. And he confirms a story that's in our book. In our book, we quote Trump telling John Kelly, why can't you effing generals be like the German generals? And he says, what German generals? He means Hitler's generals? Yes, he means Hitler's generals. Hitler's generals. And John Kelly, of course, tells him, well, wait a second. By the way, you know, they tried to kill him three times. Not that Trump knows his history or anything like that. But, you know, he also told staff that he thought Hitler did some good things. And this has all been reported before, but it's coming out again now, I think, at a moment during the election to remind people of what we're talking about. And you're right, the guardrails are gone. There will not be a Jim Mattis or an H.R. McMaster or a John Kelly or John Bolton. around him. He has learned that people like that, establishment Republicans, military officers, Mark Milley, for instance, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who says he's a fascist to the core, will not be there to stop him from using the military to go after protesters in the streets the way he did last time. And so I think it'll be, in that way, a different White House. If you want to know what this next term could be like, read our book. And for all things he wanted to do, tried to do, and was either talked out of or prevented from doing by the people around him, because he's going to try again and he won't be stopped the same way.
Mm. Well, and I also think that really this underscores another theme of this 2024 election, unfortunately, which is what you might call Trump amnesia. It's not that it was a secret that Donald Trump had said things that were admiring of Adolf Hitler when he was in the White House. That had been reported. It had been reported that he admired Hitler's generals, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, appointed by Trump himself, warned that Donald Trump did not subscribe to the very principles that led the United States to fight Hitler in World War II. These things were known, and yet somehow we've become inured to them. We've ignored them. Even many people who are highly critical of Donald Trump have accepted so many things that you can't believe that they could possibly accept. They accept his frame, many of his lies about how great the economy was under him, much of it untrue. They've forgotten in an act of collective amnesia that surely will be studied by social scientists for many years to come. Donald Trump wasn't president 15 years ago. You know, he was simply president 4 years ago. And how is it possible that in such a short period of time, we've managed to glide over so many facts that would be eye-popping in any other respect? So I think Trump amnesia, along with the inability of our system to hold him accountable, those are two of the, I think, signature themes of this 2024 election.
Mm. And what about this term being used, General Kelly used it, others have too, fascist? I mean, it's coming up again. What do you make of this term getting a lot of play at this point in this election?
Well, I mean, it's being used as, a proxy for dictatorship, right? Or authoritarianism, autocracy, pick your word. You know, John Bolton, for instance, who's no Trump fan, in fact, quite the opposite, says that Trump is very dangerous, but he doesn't think he's a fascist because fascism is actually kind of an ideology, and that Trump isn't, you know, thoughtful enough to have an ideology, but he's just simply all out for himself. That's what John Bolton, his former national security advisor, says. So, you know, John Kelly and I think Mark Milley are using this term fascist, at least in part, to describe somebody they believe who doesn't believe in the ideals of democracy, doesn't believe in checks on power, doesn't believe in the Constitution as we have known it, doesn't believe that anybody should stop him from doing what he wants to do. And I'll tell you, you know, it's interesting. When I covered him for the 4 years for the New York Times, I spent a lot of time traveling with him, and we did some interviews with him and so forth, both for the book and then for the newspaper. And I remember being on the plane with him one time, and he had just met with Xi Jinping from China. And he was waxing jealously, enviously, of the fact that Xi Jinping could do whatever he wanted, didn't have a Congress he had to satisfy, didn't have agencies who would get in the way, didn't have courts who would cause him a problem. If he wanted to put somebody on trial, Trump said, and execute him for fentanyl distribution, he could have it done by the end of the day. And Trump said this with a, gosh, wouldn't that be great kind of tone, right? That's the way he looks at things. And why does he look at things that way? Because his entire life was spent in business, not in politics, not in public service, the only president who never spent a day in the military or public service before becoming president. He was the head of his own company, the Trump Organization, a family company with no shareholders, no board of directors, nobody to be accountable for. If he said it, it happened. Mm. And that's his view of government. That should be like that, too. He should be able to snap his fingers and Congress should do what he says or the court should do what he says and so forth. We have another anecdote in our book. When he got mad at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for ruling against him on an immigration policy, he says, cancel the court, as if, you know, it was up to him to a limited court because he didn't like the ruling.
I mean, help me think about this, because I feel like a lot of the stories and a lot of your reporting supports this idea of Trump sort of a little bit of a bull in a china shop, but there's a lot of guardrails around him and he can't do quite as much damage, perhaps, as he was planning to do or might have been able to do if left unchecked. And yet there's also, I was reading, Peter, some of your recent reporting in The Times where you wrote about how Trump has been operating sort of shadow presidency from Mar-a-Lago in these years since he's left the White House, where a lot of foreign leaders are coming to meet him and talk with him and sort of court him as not just a former president, but maybe a someday again president. So help me think about Trump's power, his influence. I mean, what does it look like materially? Is he actually more powerful than people think? Is he less influential than people think? It feels a little paradoxical sometimes.
Well, look, first of all, it's important to understand that were he to become president again, our system invests enormous authority, in particular around national security and foreign policy, in the president. And he will have a wide hand, and he would represent a pretty radical shift in not only what's happening here inside the United States, but in American leadership in the world, America's position in the world. In some ways, as Peter just pointed out, his open admiration for America's adversaries and consistent denigration of our allies is one of the most consistent through lines that we've seen with Donald Trump. It's something at his core. In fact, that's one of the most remarkable things, I think, that we reported in our book about Trump in his first term that people haven't grabbed onto. They were trying to explain to him in the spring of his first year in office in 2017, how NATO and Article 5 of NATO, that's the self-mutual defense provision, works. And he interrupted them and he said, wait a minute, are you saying to me that I have to go to war for Lithuania? Like, I'm not going to freaking go to war for Lithuania. And so, in effect, NATO is already, in some ways, a dead letter on day one of another Trump presidency, in that Putin and any other adversaries would understand very much that the United States is no longer the security guarantor that it's been in the past. The reason the world leaders are coming to Mar-a-Lago and calling Trump on the phone, why they were lining up to meet with him during the UN General Assembly this fall in New York, the reason for that is because many of them are in complete panic, especially many of America's allies, and they are desperately trying to figure out how to hedge against the possibility of a second Trump term, whereas many of America's adversaries are thinking, you know, this might be good for them.
Well, let's turn now to Vice President Kamala Harris, because there's so many historic things to talk about in her campaign as well that I want to make sure we also have time for. I mean, she got into the race really just a few months ago. It's easy to forget this, but she's basically only had about 100 days to mount a presidential campaign. How would you characterize what she has managed to do in this very short time? What do you think she has succeeded at, and what do you think she has struggled with?
Well, I think she's surprised a lot of people, right? So for the first 3 years in her time as vice president, what we heard around Washington was universal disappointment among Democrats. Couldn't figure out what she really stood for. She wasn't impressing them. So when she suddenly has the nod to be Biden's replacement on the ticket, I think she started off from kind of a low base in that sense, and then just impressed everybody, right? Because within 24 hours, she had locked up the whole thing. She had eliminated any potential competition for the nomination. She had cemented the support of the party behind her, and not just cemented their support in a reluctant way, but very quickly, I think, energized them in a way they have not been for years, really. My friend Chuck Todd from NBC says it's because, you know, she was feeding food to a crowd of starving people, right? They had grown so upset at Biden's seeming inability to compete that they had grown despondent, and anybody, you know, who was half decent was going to come along and look better by comparison. But she didn't just come along and look better than Biden. She's now for 100 days put together a pretty flawless campaign. Now, she made mistakes, yes, but relatively minor. And she attracted back all of those disaffected Democrats who had left Biden because they were upset with him because he was too old, or because of inflation or immigration or whatever they were upset at. She brought a lot of those people back. Now, has she gotten all of them back? No, this is where her challenge is. She reached a certain plateau level and she, you know, tied and or went slightly ahead of Trump. But what she needs to do now is maximize the turnout of people who really are already there for her and see if she can't peel off at least a handful of these very few uncommitted people left who may actually vote. I'm not sure most of these uncommitted people are going to vote. But remember, there's not a majority in the country for Trump. There never has been. He didn't win a majority of the popular vote in 2016, even though he won the Electoral College. He didn't have the support of a majority in a Gallup poll for a single day of his presidency. Unlike every other president in our history had at least the support of a majority at least some point in their presidency. He never did. He didn't win the majority of the popular vote, obviously, in 2020 either. And he hasn't had a majority support in the approval ratings since then. So we know that more Americans than not don't want Donald Trump to be president. The question is whether Kamala Harris can convince all those people that it's okay to vote for her.
I mean, what parts of her success in creating all of this energy and excitement can be attributed to her, to her campaign, to their savvy, to their choices and decision making versus just natural momentum and excitement at some big change happening so close to Election Day?
Yeah, I think that's an important question. I mean, we are looking at such a polarized moment, right? It's, you know, politics is team sport. So when the team finally has a new leader, people are going to get excited about that, I think, especially in an environment where they perceive Donald Trump to be nearly an existential level threat. But I think it's more than that. I was very impressed this summer, as I think a lot of people were who had been skeptical about Kamala Harris, that first of all, she's clearly grown as a communicator, as a politician. Those rallies that she held this summer, her debut, her convention, they were as good as any summer of campaigning I've seen in presidential politics. So that was number one. Number two, her debate performance against Donald Trump was very strong. And, you know, you saw even many Republican commentators acknowledging that. It's the reason why Donald Trump refused to have another debate with Kamala Harris. And yet, you know, to the extent there's questions, what it revolves around is, was there more that could have been done for her to capitalize on that victory in September and to build momentum from there? Or conversely, was it just that she didn't have a lot more room to grow, that we're in such a polarized environment that, you know, she used the summer, as Peter said, to kind of consolidate the Democrats who were not consolidated, who were still upset about Biden. She pulled the party together. And now here we are in, you know, what does somebody say, the knife fight in the phone booth that we always expected all along. So, you know, people will be analyzing it. Certainly, if she's defeated, there are going to be a lot of questions about, I think Biden's going to get enormous blowback once again for his decision to run again until it was very, very late in the game. That's going to be one thing. Two, people will wonder, was she the best standard bearer? Should the party have somehow managed to have a primary, or did Biden's exit, was it so untimely that it was impossible? That's the kind of conversation that will occur inevitably. It might not even wait for the polls to close, depending on how things are happening. You know, we're already hearing some of that in Washington even now. It's a very, very nervous October for Democrats.
Mm. How do you see Harris sort of conducting herself and posturing herself in contrast to the Trump campaign? We've seen the Trump campaign's rhetoric and Trump himself using racist, darker rhetoric at his campaigns. How do you think Harris is responding to that?
Well, she's shifted from the joy section of the campaign to the contrast section of the campaign, right? I think that there was this feeling at
contrast,
first.
How about panic?
Well, but not just, but her message is not panic. Her message is contrast, right? Her message is, I mean.
Well, her message is actually like, you know,
well,
panic because Donald Trump could blow up the country.
Yes. Okay, but it's, right.
Yeah, there's an urgency to it for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, there's an odd conspiracy right now between Republicans and Democrats. Both of them, for their own reasons, are presenting the notion that Trump might win. Trump and his people are pushing it because they want to, A, convince Republicans that they can win, which had not always been a given, and B, that if he loses, he can say, well, I got cheated because clearly I was going to win. We all know I was going to win. Everybody said I was going to win. And if I didn't win, that must be because somebody did something wrong. The Democrats have an interest in portraying Trump as about to win in order to, as you said, create urgency among their voters, to panic them, to make sure that they know this is for real, not to be complacent. A lot of 2016 Democrats might have been complacent, thinking Hillary Clinton had it in the bag because polls seemed to think that she did. She didn't, obviously. And in fact, maybe that was true in 2020 as well, because Biden was well ahead and didn't win by nearly as much as the polls suggested he could have won by had everybody turned out. So I think you're right. Both sides have their own conspiracy for the different reasons to want to make everybody realize that Trump can win here, and he can win here. This really is a jump ball, and nothing is going to happen the next week in terms of the polling that's going to give us enough information to know before Election Day or even within a day or two after Election Day who's going to win this thing.
Yeah, sure. Susan, I know you've been thinking about this quite a bit and thinking about Hillary Clinton in 2016. I mean, what will it say about us as a country if we are, in fact, able to elect our first woman president? What would it mean?
Well, that's right. You know, I think we focus a lot on the, you know, almost the catastrophizing about what another Trump term would mean, not only in a narrow sense for the country, but in a big picture historical sense. And it's almost like Democrats have been reluctant to look at the alternate scenario. And it is a very different story that would emerge if Donald Trump was essentially bookended between the historic presidency of Barack Obama, the country's first African-American president, and that of Kamala Harris, not only the first woman president, but also a woman of color. And yet she has not, you asked about her as a campaigner, she has not focused and drawn attention to the kind of barrier-breaking nature of her candidacy in the way that Hillary Clinton in 2016 chose to lean into the breaking the glass ceiling element of her candidacy. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton, when she first ran for president back in 2008, when she lost to Barack Obama, actually she was criticized by many Democrats for not emphasizing her gender enough. And so in a way, 2016, right, was her response to that. It just shows you that Democrats are very good at second guessing their candidates no matter which way they go. And especially if you're a
damn
woman.
Damn if you do, damn if
yeah,
you don't.
But especially if you're a woman. And I do think the building rage among many, many women, even women who are not of the, you know, stand on the barricades and shout kind of variety. That is a theme and potentially an underestimated theme in this election as well. And I'm sure you've had this experience. I have definitely had this experience in recent days of so many women that I know saying, well, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not sure what to think of these polls. But, you know, if Kamala Harris wins, it's women who are going to pull her through. It's women who are going to make the difference. Obviously, they're responding in part to suggestions in the surveys that this is going to be not only a gender gap, but a historic gender gap. And, you know, the younger that you are, the bigger the gender gap appears to be in the polls this year. That is something that is very hard to measure, but certainly in terms of the intensity of the feeling among many women, I've been really struck by that, especially because even 2 years after the Supreme Court threw out Roe versus Wade, my view is that there are many men in our society, even those who support Harris, who may not understand the incredible potency of this issue, the way in which it resonates for women of every age, despite what J.D. Vance says that, you know, somehow women over 50 or 60 shouldn't even be care about reproductive freedom in this country. That is definitely not the lived experience of the women that I've encountered. I think that's what's powering the Harris candidacy in many non-obvious ways. And obviously, if she wins, that's going to become a big part of the history that's written about this campaign.
What happens to Trump and what happens to the MAGA movement if Harris wins?
Well, I mean, Trump himself, let's first of all, he has a great deal of legal exposure, first of all. He has a conviction of 34 felonies. The sentencing will be held after the election. Our team did a study and found that 42% of defendants in New York who were convicted on charges similar to his faced prison time. And you could argue that he has a greater chance of that in the sense that he was such a poorly behaved, let's say, defendant in court. That usually doesn't help you when a judge comes time to sentencing you. And of course, he's obviously expressed no remorse or anything like that. Then he has three other cases, one of which has been dismissed, the classified documents case. But there's a good chance that it gets reinstated because the reason it was dismissed was because of the way the special counsel was appointed, even though that way has been approved by other courts in the past. We'll see what happens there. And then we had the two 2020 cases, one Georgia, one federal court case. And at least one of those seems likely to go to trial. The immunity decision that Susan referenced from the Supreme Court complicates it, and so we can't make any predictions. But he's got a lot of legal exposure ahead of him if he doesn't win. If he does win, obviously, he can try to make those go away. And that's why it's such a consequential election for him personally. Now, MAGA movement's a different question. It's a very good question. We don't know the answer to, but it's an important one. If he had lost by a large margin, which doesn't seem to be likely even if he does lose, that would be one thing. It might therefore discredit the movement to some extent and make Republicans rethink where they are going. But if he loses by a small amount, by a narrow defeat like he did in the three states or five states, really, of 2020, then, you know, they can keep it going. They can make the argument they were cheated, and this still might have a hold over other Republicans who might want to move on but would fear crossing the Trump base. It depends. He can be popular as a martyr and still dictate to the party. We would have thought after January 6th when he was impeached for the second time, when all the Republicans, a lot of the Republicans anyway, said that he was responsible, whether they voted for conviction or not, you would have thought they would have said, okay, that's enough. Let's not follow a guy who's just lost twice and try to overturn an election. Let's look for a person who can move us to the next generation. But it's a different kind of movement than a traditional political scenario. So I'm not sure about that. Do you have a better feeling?
You know, look, we're 9 years into the Trump era in American politics, and the idea that the Republican Party is going back, they're the ones who aren't going back. And it doesn't mean that we have a clear sense yet, I think, what they're going forward to. But we're now looking at, I think, a next wave of political realignment in this country, of which, you know, Trump has profited from, capitalized from, and arguably accelerated. And so we don't quite know exactly where that realignment will go, but it will continue. And it will certainly not, we're not going to wake up one morning and find some kind of George W. Bush Republican, you know, and his kind of hawkish Main Street Republicans back in charge of the party.
No, but I would add one thing, though. I do think that Trump is sui generis. Like, I think a lot of people who are MAGA Republicans and essentially try to emulate him fall flat. They just don't, they don't have the same connection to that base in this, that he does. It'll have to be something different. It won't be snapped back, I agree. It's not going to be George W. Bush's party, but it's also not going to be Donald Trump's party in the same way, because I don't think J.D. We watched J.D. Vance. He didn't have a control over that crowd the way Trump does. He, you know,
oh, yeah, at the Madison Square Garden event that we just attended, I think this is really important. You know what the biggest applause line is? Again, we're 9 years into this with Trump. The biggest applause line is saying his name. Many of the warm-up speakers, that's what they would get the applause for, is Donald J. Trump, and then everybody would clap. And frankly, a lot of the other stuff they said wasn't all that exciting to the crowd.
It's personality-based politics. You could call it a cult of personality. Obviously, some people do. And so when he leaves the scene in whatever fashion he does, I don't think somebody steps in and has the same capacity with that crowd. The party's got to rethink itself a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about really what sounds like two competing visions for America. And this is what I keep thinking about. I mean, what do we do in this country where we have such a vast divide between those two visions for America and such a complete coin toss between those two? What do we do with that after Election Day?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of why it feels like such a catastrophe and so anxiety-producing, is because up until now, the response has been, you know, there's just the election. We'll get through the election and then somehow we'll just check back out of politics. And you could argue that that was one of the great failures, actually, of the Biden presidency, was this idea that, okay, it was really tough, it was horrible, it was traumatic, January 6th, but Trump was defeated, and now we'll just move on. And you know, for a lot of blue America, I think they moved on and checked out of the possibility that we were just as divided and possibly even more so in some very threatening ways than we had been before the election of 2020. There's this quote that has just been haunting me in Bob Woodward has a new book out this fall, and he has a quote that he attributes to Ron Klain, Joe Biden's first chief of staff early on in the presidency, January or February of 2021. And he very confidently is predicting, Donald Trump is just going to be a sideshow. He's over. And, you know, I think that was a fatal miscalculation for something that really, frankly, overshadowed and hung over every single day of the Biden presidency. And so my worry is that, once again, we might be in a situation where whichever is the winning side believes that their triumph is more complete and total than in fact it is. And that, you know, we're in a situation where, frankly, structurally speaking, I think the dynamics are in place for us to continue to be pulled farther and farther apart as you have a cycle of reaction and retribution and legislating in blue states and red states that pulls kind of the legal commonalities between those two farther and farther apart, regardless of who wins the election.
Well, and I would just add, I think that I don't see a figure on the horizon who can unify the country, Republican, Democrat, whatever. I mean, if Harris wins, she will have won by a very narrow majority, and I don't see her being able to overcome that. Biden arguably at least had the profile of somebody who could have theoretically done a better job uniting the country, because he couldn't do it, maybe because they didn't take it seriously enough, or because
he became... because Republicans were determined to make him a failure as a president. And
that is
a cycle that we've seen again and again as well, is that there's no possibility to negotiate with people who refuse to negotiate with
you. I'm not even talking about negotiating. I'm talking about finding a way to unify the country, not the Congress and the parties. I just mean to reach out to people beyond the people who elected you. And I think that's just, I think it will elude anybody at this point. We don't have somebody like a Reagan or a Kennedy or whoever who has the capacity to appeal to people who might not naturally be part of their party.
Hmm. Well, it's also, though, I just would say that it's not even a question of wanting to appeal across the partisan divide, but in fact, our campaigns are almost ensuring and guaranteeing that it's impossible to do so. Because when you say that the other team, it's not that you disagree about what kind of healthcare system anymore to have in our country. We're now telling our own voters they are an existential threat to the nation. They will destroy America. Donald Trump says again and again and again in every single one of his recent rallies that I've listened to, he says, we will not even have a country anymore if the other side wins. In that kind of apocalyptic framing, of course it's not possible to reach across the divide. There's no politician. I will say—
I'm not faulting anybody. I'm just saying I don't think it's going to happen.
But that's a difference between Harris and Trump as well, because she has been using the old form. She does say in many of her speeches, I want to be a president for all Americans. She's been campaigning around the battleground states with Liz Cheney and emphasizing the idea that she would return to the tradition of having a Republican as a member of her cabinet and things like that. So, you know, she is actually making some of the more traditional bipartisan noises, in part because she thinks it's a good campaign strategy maybe to peel off some of those Republican establishment voters from Trump in the final days. But I think it's going to be very impossible when now we've had multiple elections in a row in which the other party is being described as an existential level event for the United States.
Any last thoughts before I let you go as we inch closer to the day?
We're so closely divided that it's remarkable. I've never seen, I've covered politics 38 years and even studied elections for long before that. I cannot think of an election that was this close to election day. Now, they were very close on election day in some cases, but they closed in the last few days. This one has stayed static for a long time. It has been even for a long time and is going even all the way up to election day. And we just don't know.
I would say that, you know, Peter and I began our professional careers together in Washington, but our first assignment of our married life was in Russia, in Vladimir Putin's Russia, at the very beginning of what turned out to be a more than two decades as Russia's longest serving leader since Joseph Stalin. And, you know, what we saw in those 4 years that we were in Russia was how fragile a democracy can be. And this was, of course, was a new democracy, nothing like the United States with our history and traditions. But the speed and rapidity with which Putin was able to make radical changes in Russia and to undo the democratic progress that had been done. And, you know, there's a playbook that's now become the playbook used in many other countries, not just in Russia, in Hungary, in Turkey, in other parts of the world. And, you know, if we've learned anything in the last 9 years, it's that things we took for granted in our own democracy, we probably shouldn't take for granted. And I think for us, that was really a formative experience. I would just say to people that the time to defend these institutions is before they're taken away. So, you know, it really matters.
Susan, Peter, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Peter Baker is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, and Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker. They co-authored a book about the Trump presidency called The Divider. For the latest election coverage, you can follow the Election 2024 channel on the Apple News app.